My name is Julie Silverstein. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome everyone here in the room and also online, and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Seeing the Unseen, Early Recognition and Individualized Management of Acromegaly. This program is supported by an educational grant from Crinetics Pharmaceuticals. Today's activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning, jointly accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians. Of note, this activity may include discussions of products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the FDA. We have all been informed that we are responsible that we should disclose to the audience if we are discussing any off-label or investigational uses, such as any uses not approved by the FDA of any products or devices. Again, as I said, my name is Julie Silverstein. I'm medical director of the Pituitary Center and clinical trials unit director and professor of medicine and neurological surgery in the Division of Endocrinology, Metabolism, and Lipid Research at Washington University School of Medicine. I'm excited to be joined by my two colleagues, Wenyu Wang and Jill Sisko, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Thank you, Dr. Silverstein. Good evening, everyone. My name is Wenyu Huang. I'm a surgery professor at Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine, and I'm also serve as the core lab director of the clinical research unit. I also supervise our pituitary and adrenal clinic. Now, Jill.
Hello, I'm Jill Sisko, and I'm a patient, and I am also the president of Acromegaly Community. And as you can see from my before picture that's up on the screen, I am what effective treatment looks like.
So we're going to start with an audience response question. Which of the following is most likely to present as an early clinical sign of acromegaly? Okay, let's see what everyone said. So we have the 9% visual field defects, about 30% secondary amenorrhea, and 32% enlargement of hands and feet. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting mix, right? So we got all the key points hit here, and then first of all, we look at, I think that most of people put in large hands and feet. Definitely, yep. That's a result of the high IGF-1 growth hormones. Mm-hmm. In my clinic, you know, the hyperglycemia do happen, and I think depending on their baseline status, right, they are obese to begin with, they probably have more risk of developing that earlier in the disease process. And, you know, if they are very lean people to begin with, they may develop hyperglycemia a little worse. And the secondary amenorrhea is mostly, in my opinion, is tumor effect. When the tumor is big, it can cause effect on the, you know, gonadotropes, causing secondary amenorrhea.
I agree. Okay, so now our first learning objective is to integrate strategies aligned with guideline recommendations to diagnose acromegaly early in the disease course. So what do the guidelines say? And I'm going to ask Dr. Wang to address diagnosis and pathophysiology of acromegaly.
Thank you, Dr. Silverstein. So as you all know, I think most of your endocrinologists were at least dealing with acromegaly. You know acromegaly is a chronic disease, right? That's caused by excessive production of growth hormone, and then usually that's due to a pituitary tumor. And growth hormone indeed, and then later on there's another slide that will show that it will increase IGF-1 level. Those are the two culprit of all the clinical phenotypes that we see. It's a rare disease that we all know. The incidence is about somewhere between 0.2 to 1.1 new cases per 100,000 people per year. And the prevalence, as you see, is quite big. The difference is somewhere between 2.8 to 14 per 100,000 people. But I believe that's probably the prevalence will expect to go up because now there are people living longer. I think this problem will go up. Unfortunately, despite all this many years of effort, both on the patient side and the provider side, there's still quite a bit of diagnosis delay, and the quoted number usually somewhere between 4 to 6 years. And then it's amazingly 25% of the patients actually they were diagnosed 10 years after the disease onset. So quite dramatic difference. And also, unfortunately, there's also some sex differences, and women tend to have a delayed, more delayed diagnosis as compared to men. And, you know, the literature says somewhere between 4 to 5 years. Right. So there are certain risk factors. If you see a patient, you may consider maybe screening for IGF-1 or acromegaly. We've been thinking about acromegaly. So on the left side, there are some genetic risk factors. If patient haven't had MEN1, MEN4, with all these mutations, you can, does the patient look different since last time you saw the patient? Maybe you think about it. There's some patient with AIP mutation and also carny complex mutation, also GPR101, which is really rare disease, though. I mean, those are the factors I would think. And also, I would ask the patient for family history of pituitary tumor as well. So that will give you some I'll call them pre-test possibility. Before you test them, you have some sort of idea like, okay, this patient I'm going to rule out or I'm going to rule in. Now, the non-genetic components are a variety of them. And the genetic studies show that 40% of those patients with growth hormone secreting tumors have mutation of the GNAS genes. So I'm just skip the others. And then so, you know, here I mentioned GHR secreting tumor, which is extremely rare. So I think, you know, these are the things you can consider if things doesn't play right. Now, you can see that this is the burden of the disease, right? So it is a disease with really high burden. We just discussed about the delayed diagnosis. And also nearly about a quarter of patients have, you know, a delay of 10 years or more. And that has consequences because the delayed diagnosis can increase mortality and morbidity over time. And then the major comorbidity, as you can see here down there, is cardiovascular disease, diabetes, sleep apnea, arthritis. The list can go on. Now, if you think of the major mortality in this disease, years ago, the top three are cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, and malignancy. Now, that number, those three have changed over the years. Now, malignancy turned out to be the number one cause of death in this patient population, followed by cardiovascular disease and pulmonary disease. I believe that because the patients are living longer with more effective treatment, and then the whole landscape actually changed over time. Also, please don't forget, there's also psychological components when patients having the disease, and depression, stigma, and, you know, and also isolation, and their body image disorders may also happen as a result of the disease.
Jill, do you want to sort of add anything in there, what you hear from your patients? And
well, I can tell you that the experience isn't just clinical. It's emotional. You know, patients can tell that there's something wrong long before they get a diagnosis. It's a struggle for patients.
Absolutely. I completely agree with Jill just said. Okay, so this is slides similar to what we had talked earlier about. So if you focus on the right side, looking at the image, you can see that there is, you know, most commonly you would see a pituitary tumor that lead to increased secretion of growth hormone. And most of the growth hormone go to the liver to produce IGF-1. Some of it go to the bone to produce IGF-1. And then the growth hormone either directly or indirectly via IGF-1 will have cause somatic growth. In the case of kids, will be gigantism. In the adults, will be acromegaly. And also metabolic dysfunctions because, you know, the growth hormone have many effect on the metabolism. And then, as I said, most commonly, this is the pituitary adenoma. Pituitary carcinoma, extremely rare. And also, if, you know, there is ectopic secretion of GHR or GHRH, these are also extremely rare as well. So mainly we're dealing with a pituitary adenoma. And some of those adenoma, though, can be aggressive. You know, some are relatively not aggressive. And I diagnosis about 2/3 of the patients actually have microadenoma. So just keep in mind, usually that's probably because of the delay of the diagnosis.
Right. I think that's an important point. Although I will say that with more and more incidentally found pituitary microadenomas, I find I've been diagnosing it more early on, which is, I guess, a good thing, you know, one thing about finding all these pituitary adenomas.
Right. And then I definitely echo what Dr. Silverstein just said, but when you see those macroadenoma, please check IGF-1.
Oh, check IGF-1 and anybody with a pituitary adenoma.
Exactly. Yes. That's the very key point.
Yes, it can be mild. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, if they come to the stage of the paper that you see, right, you can see on those sides of those pictures with large hands and feet, also phlognathism, you know, they have underbite, they have macroglossia. Those are usually well into the disease, probably a few years into the disease. What we are trying to do, hopefully, you know, with some help, and we can identify those diseases earlier. There's some dermatological disease that also come together with acromegaly, for example, skin tag, thickening of the skin, excessive sweating, and all the skin. Jill, do you recall at the very beginning, do you have some of these symptoms?
I had all of these symptoms. Yeah. But one of my first that isn't discussed a lot was weight gain. Mm. And I hear that in so many patients, unexplained weight gain. So in my opinion, we need to take note of that whenever that is presented.
That's a very good point here, yeah. And then, you know, and unfortunately, you know, acromegaly is not just a disease of a growth hormone. You know, for adults, you're done with growing. But the issue is also because the distribution of the growth hormone receptor and the IGF-1 receptor are so broad that you can have other comorbidities. Listed here a few of them, right? So the headaches and fatigue, and it could be just because of the tumor or because there's growth hormone effect. And, you know, the endocrine system, we mentioned earlier, there's some menstrual irregularity that you can see, but those are usually happening in bigger tumors. And also, from the endocrine standpoint, right, so those tumors also, not only the tumor itself, but also too much of growth hormone can cause insulin resistance. People have diabetes, or at least more risk of diabetes. And sleep apnea is very common. I always ask my patient about, you know, snoring. And also oncological, as I mentioned, it become one of the major cause of mortality in this patient group. So the two common ones is colon cancer and thyroid cancer. So those are the two that I usually look out for.
So yeah, I was going to ask you, what do you recommend for patients in terms of colon cancer screening?
That's a very good question. So normally I don't think there's age cutoff. I'm more on the more proactive side. Mm-hmm. I usually screen every single one of my the first diagnosis. And then there is a guideline on how to screen after that, depending on whether there was a polyp found, right? So if there's no polyp, and also especially when their IGF-1 is well controlled, you can just screening as if the normal population. But if not, then the patient's still at risk. You would rather bring them back in 5 years if there's no polyps. Thyroid cancer, I think people do it differently. This definitely, there was a guideline how to do that. I personally definitely do exam. And if I do find a nodule, and I'll go ahead and do it. For older patients, I'll just do it.
An ultrasound makes
ultrasound of the thyroid, yeah.
Yeah, I do the same thing, and I recommend colonoscopy as soon as someone's diagnosed, although sometimes it's hard to get it covered by insurance, I will say.
That's actually very true. So I guess we have to fight for our patients.
Yes.
So often with the patients within our group, they don't know that they're supposed to have a colonoscopy at diagnosis. And that's something that you really need to stress with patients.
Yeah, and then for you, there is a really good article published by the ACRO Consensus Group. That was, I think it's 2022. They list all the comorbidities associated with. A lot of time you had to engage other subspecialties, pulmonologists, right, oncologists, or gastroenterologists. You have a whole group of doctors. And so then the patient is not just seeing us, a neurosurgeon, neuro-oncologist, is a whole group of doctors. I think if you have a chance, read that comorbidity paper. It was very well laid out there. Okay, so this is another tricky question, right? So why we're missing diagnosis? It seems like we're doing MRI more often than we do. And I think the key part is the disease onset is so insidious. I mean, it's only the patient don't even realize they have changed, and the family don't even realize they changed. I personally have a 19-year-old boy. He came to me with a newly diagnosed a big tumor. And, you know, when you see him, I think all the audience can recognize this kid have acromegaly. But he's from a physician's family. Mm-hmm. They didn't even realize that until they have a family reunion in Texas. And then some of the radiologist family noticed, oh, you look different than I saw you 3 years ago. Why don't you get a growth hormone IGF-1 check? So that's how the tumor and also the acromegaly was diagnosed. You see how even for well-educated medical professionals, sometimes you can even miss the diagnosis, still less than the general population. So I think it's just a disease. It's so insidious. It's really hard to diagnose. However, though, as I mentioned, like Jill mentioned, there are maybe something we can consider the risk factors, you know, and, you know, let's say the weight gain. If you have a constellation of symptoms, at least think about it. Of course, when you see a pituitary tumor, please do it. Because there will be some mild ones that will be missed. I mean, even us, when we look at the patient, we may not think acromegaly, but indeed, the IGF-1 is elevated. Mm. So, let's move on. All right. So this is, I think we propose some, the guideline proposed some stepwise diagnosis approach. You know, if you think about the clinical signs of acromegaly, you measure IGF-1, you found a tumor on the pituitary gland, you measure IGF-1, right? And, or in some patients, let's say if you have, you know, diabetes, which is not well controlled, and then you all have to think about something endocrine-wise that can cause it. You know, Cushing's and acromegaly could be just two of them. So if you do the test and then you turn out to be have a normal IGF-1, you basically say it's pretty much I'm ruling out the disease. And then to the other stream on the right, you can see if the patient have typical, you know, signs and symptoms of acromegaly. And I think elevated IGF-1, you pretty much just, you know, say rule in you have a disease. And then the next job is to figure out how big the tumor, where the tumor, and things like that. So as I said, you know, oftentimes you will find a tumor. Now, the middle part sometimes can be tricky, especially the patient don't present with all the symptoms and signs of acromegaly, and then all the IGF-1 is only mildly elevated. In those cases, sometimes the guideline says you can engage glucose tolerance test or glucose tolerance to see whether the growth hormone is suppressed or not. So Dr. Silverstein have some thoughts on that.
Maybe, yeah, so I think there's some caveats to the oral glucose tolerance test. And something I always tell our trainees and everybody when I'm asked about it is, one, it can be normal in patients with mild acromegaly. So it may not completely rule it out in someone with mild acromegaly who may be the patient you're ordering it for because their IGF-1 is only slightly elevated. And on the flip side, you know, lean, young females and even some young men and women on estrogen may not suppress normally, so they may have a false positive. So I think this test can be really tricky.
Very good point. So this is what the current guideline says. If the IGF-1 is higher than 1.3 times the upper limb normal plus typical symptoms and signs of acromegaly, remember we're seeing a patient, that's just about a chemical test, then I think you can pretty much sure this patient have acromegaly. And then Dr. Silverstein also mentioned the usage of the OGT test in limited patients. Now the other thing is the estrogen. So if your patient is on estrogen, because estrogen can induce a what we call IGF-1, like growth hormone resistant the liver, the test itself may not be very accurate. You probably need to get them off the estrogen and retest them 4 weeks later. So those are some nuances when you're testing or diagnosing the acromegaly. And then the last thing is the assay. The assay is very important. You know the assay and what calibrator they used, and what about interference, because there is growth hormone, there's also IGF-1 binding proteins that sometimes can interfere with those assays. So these are some teeny tiny details.
Before you go on, we've had a couple people ask, what do we mean by mildly elevated IGF-1?
Okay, that's a very good question. So if the patient, I would say, according to the guidelines, at least somewhere between 1 to 1.3 times the upper limit normal, let's say 1.2, you could actually repeat the IGF-1 first, and then you can move on to the OGT, given all the caveat we just talked about. And also, I think there is something we tried to improve over the last 10 years has now gained the unanimous harmony first, is because the assay with the IGF-1 growth hormone. Everybody was talking about, hopefully we got one single one nationwide, but we never reached that goal. And every single test itself has some pitfalls and also advantages as well, so just keep in mind of those. Now, the number listed there, these are newer assays, definitely not the older assay, right? So the older assay, we use the color as 1. Now, the newer assay take consideration of the good calibrator and also the methodology. So keep those in mind. All right, so this is basically a summarize we just talked about. Oh, the other one thing, Dr. Silverstein, I wanted to mention about the prolactin. How do you deal with that usually?
Right. So, I mean, you know, anybody with a macrorat, well, we check prolactin in anybody with an adenoma. And definitely with a macroadenoma, you're going to want to assess for hypopituitarism. And then, of course, you know, up to 30% of patients could have adenoma that's co-secreting prolactin.
Very good point here. So I should personally have a patient, you know, the patient actually presented with hypogonadotropic hypogonism. And I think the urologist was really good getting a prolactin level check. Of course, prolactin was high, and the patient also then found a pituitary tumor, and then the job was done. Unfortunately, the IGF-1 was missed. So for those of you, I think if you're thinking this is a prolactinoma, Please also check idea one, like Dr. Silverstein says, sometimes they co-secrete. Mm-hmm. There could be several scenarios. Number one is the patient do have acromegaly, the high level of prolactin is stalk effect. That's one possibility. Yeah. Number two is this is a somatotrope, electrotrope adenoma, meaning the tumor itself producing both hormones, or they have mixed tumor. They have one adenoma, which is a growth hormone adenoma, the other is electrotrope adenoma. So there's many aspects of that. Just please check idea one. And one more thing is, I have also seen some physicians, when they see a tumor, they only check growth hormone.
Oh, yeah.
They miss the IGF-1, so please check, because growth hormone is
pulsatile. And ACTH.
Right. Growth hormone is pulsatile release, and then the normal range of growth hormone is so high, you can easily say, oh, it's normal, I'm done. No, in those cases, I think I've seen a couple of cases where acromegaly was missed because of that. So these are some. So I'll get back to Dr. Silverstein talking about cases.
Yeah, so now we have a case. We have a 32-year-old man who was referred to endocrinology by his primary care practitioner after a dentist noted changes in his jaw alignment during a routine exam. He reported his voice had become deeper over the past year, and he had to upsize his shoes twice in the prior 18 months. He also complains of persistent fatigue and difficulty sleeping. Others had noticed a progressive underbite and facial changes, and he had increased shoe and ring size over the past year. So in terms of his history, he had hypertension, type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, on CPAP, and left ventricular hypertrophy. His exam was significant for multiple skin tags, frontal bossing, prognathism, macroglossia, enlarged hands, feet, thickened skin. He actually was going to have part of his tongue removed because of the macroglossia. So his labs, he had a prolactin was slightly elevated at 29. Total testosterone was low, and the LH and FSH levels were low normal. So what would be the most appropriate next step in evaluating this patient for suspected acromegaly? So most people got it right. Yep. Measure IGF-1 concentration. And then if elevated, then you would move on to the pituitary MRI. Glad no one picked growth hormone.
Exactly.
Everybody's listening.
That's great. Thank you.
So what do these results tell us and how should we act on them? So the IGF-1 is 782 and the growth hormone is 13.2.
Yeah, so you can see that this patient, from all you understand, is very high pretest possibility for acromegaly, right? And then you look at the IGF-1 level, which is almost 4 times the upper limit normal, 3 times the upper limit normal. So this is, but the typical sign is symptoms of acromegaly with IGF-1 level this high. So you make the diagnosis.
Cisco, you want to talk about kind of the impact this might have on the patient giving them this diagnosis?
Well, for so many with acromegaly, they've gone for so many years with knowing something is wrong. It actually comes as a relief to finally know what they're fighting and get a diagnosis.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so our next learning objective is to assess the latest efficacy and safety data on current and emerging treatments for acromegaly, including novel oral therapies. So I'll be talking next about our medications, where we are now, where we're going, and what's in the future. So this sort of gives a broad view of, you know, management. So transfemoral surgery is first line in most patients, a patient who's eligible and agrees to it. If there's residual disease or surgery is not feasible or the patient refuses surgery, then we move to medical therapy. Most commonly, this would be a long-acting somatostatin receptor ligand, usually the first-generation octreotide, which is both IM and oral, or lanreotide. Pasireotide, we'll talk about in a little bit, is another SRL. We can also use dopamine agonists, cabergoline, and this is not FDA-approved for treatment in acromegaly, but we'll talk a little bit about that. And then we have pegabisomant, which can be used, or the only growth hormone receptor antagonist available on the market. I'd say radiotherapy is probably more third line, maybe more in someone where you're worried about oncologic control, like controlling the macroadenoma. And of course, we need to take into patient, you know, preferences, comorbidities, symptom burden, and all those things. So this gives you, you know, it's kind of a busy slide, but I think when I was training, you know, this was a much smaller algorithm, right? So, you know, as we said, generally you're going to go to surgery. You may go to primary medical therapy. And then if you're controlled, that's great. You monitor IGF-1. But then what are your options if you're not controlled? And you can see there's different ways of going. You might consider cabergoline. That works best in people with mild elevations. You, with somatostatin receptor ligand, if they're not controlled on that, you could, and we'll talk about it, consider switching to pasireotide, LAR, which is can be more effective than octreotide or lanreotide. You may also switch to pegvisomant, or, you know, if you're not on maximum SRL, increase the dose, or different combinations. And then radiotherapy is also an option. So there's different ways to do this.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd also like to, you know, often patients have to be on combo therapies.
Yes.
In order to help gain control of this disease.
Yes, that's very common.
Not just one, but multiple.
Yeah.
And then also I want to point out one is the reoperation, right? So especially when the first surgery was done at the center was not, don't have experienced surgeon. And then, you know, when they go into a pituitary center, when the surgeon have more experience, though that we do also give them a chance of, you know, second chance of remission, especially when the surgeon think they can remove the tumor in total.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, it's real important to, if whenever possible, have your patient go to a pituitary center where there's an experienced pituitary neurosurgeon, for sure.
You know, we have a rule of thumb within our community that the surgeon should have done at least 500 of these surgeries before they touch you. 50 per year have a high remission rate and low complications.
So we have gaps, right, in treatment for multiple reasons. We know with that, as Jill was kind of mentioning, 40 to 55% of patients are not well controlled on first-line therapy. There's also patients that have resistant tumors, and they don't get biochemical control on our first-generation SRLs. And then there's multiple barriers, right? So injections can be a burden, side effects such as hyperglycemia with pasireotide, and sometimes cost of medication can be an issue. Availability, you know, patients who live in very remote areas may have trouble going to a physician's office for injections. And sometimes there's just like therapeutic inertia, like you just kind of don't change things. Mm-hmm. So now we'll talk about sort of the different classes of medications, starting with the injectable somatostatin receptor ligands. Octreotide and lanreotide are first-generation SRLs, generally very similar in terms of their efficacy, about 55%. Octreotide is an IM injection every 4 weeks. Lanreotide is a deep subcutaneous injection every 4, or you can even sometimes do 6 weeks. The side effects are, you know, I think what you guys are probably familiar with, GI upset. And then, of course, there can be injection site reactions. And then, you know, as I kind of mentioned, that just having to get those injections, go to the doctor's office can really be a burden. Pasireotide, I'm going to let Dr. Wan talk about that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. So first of all, I think, you know, when you look at the first two numbers with octreotide and lanreotide, remember these are, the efficacy are against the placebos. When these are the drugs that's been proven many years ago, and these are, there was no standard therapy at that point. Well, when pasireotide was doing the trial, I think it was 2014, the two trial came out, but they have a standard therapy at that point, which is the first generation SRLs. But the number quoted there are more direct comparison with the first generation. So, for example, 2014, Cola and all published study looking at those drug-naive patients when they do a head-to-head comparison between pasireotide and octreotide. In that specific trial, the biochemical control, which is defined as IGF-1 level normal and growth hormone less than 2.5, And that so the pasteurized efficacy is 31%, where the octreotide is only 19%. So, and then there's another study, it's called Paula study, and looking at switch patient where the patient was not controlled with thirst adjunction and then switched to pasteurized, they get another 20%. I just wanted to know that the number there reflected those trials, not directly compared to the placebos. So,
We have a question about what we mean by control or uncontrolled, and these trials looked at IGF-1, normal IGF-1. Some of the more recent trials look at IGF-1 less than 1.3 times the upper limit of normal. And then I'm not sure for these older studies, the growth hormone cutoffs, but they may be more recent studies less than 1 or less than 2.5 in some of the studies. And then another question before we kind of move on, just a general, is, you know, how often do you monitor IGF-1 levels when patients are on treatment?
Well, that's a very good question. I think because these are already long-acting drugs, right? So if you start the medication and or you change the dose, usually it's titrating up. I usually do them 3 months later to give you enough time for the medication to work. And then that also goes back to right after surgery, right? So then just make me think that right after surgery, you know, the IGF-1 level is not very indicative. We usually check it, you know, people say 8 weeks, I do it 12 weeks, somewhere around there. Those are the checks, because IGF-1 takes a long time to come down after surgery, but the growth hormone actually, day one, day two after surgery, the growth hormone is really an indicator of whether the surgery is, you know, putting the patient in remission.
Other therapies, so I kind of mentioned cabergoline, again, not FDA approved for this indication. Studies show it works about 30% of the time as monotherapy, and it works best in patients who have more mild or moderate disease, probably IGF-1 less than 2 times the upper limit of normal. There's your dosing, a little bit different than for prolactinomas. Patients may end up on sort of higher doses. Think you're familiar. We're familiar with the side effects from our prolactinoma patients, nausea, dizziness, headaches. But it tends to be less effective as monotherapy. It can be added on to somatostatin receptor ligand. Bevacizumab is the only approved growth hormone receptor antagonist. And in certain patients, selected patients in the studies, it's effective at controlling, biochemically controlling acromegaly, meaning normal IGF-1 in over 90% of patients. It's a subcutaneous injection daily, but really some patients we end up doing it just a couple times a week or even weekly. Main side effects, so with pegvisomant, it can raise liver function, liver enzymes. So you have to monitor liver enzymes when they're on it. And, of course, injection site reaction. And we didn't really discuss that, but the somatostatin receptor ligands are associated with decrease in tumor size. We don't see that in pegvisomant, so you need to monitor with MRIs.
Yeah. Can I add with cabergoline, with one of the limitations, physicians really need to be cognizant about talking to their patients about compulsive disorders.
Yes.
I was going to mention that.
When patients are taking that medication.
Yes.
Yeah. So some of these patients actually may, you know, the most common symptoms with those impulsive behaviors are gambling.
Yes.
Shopping spree and also hypersexuality. And, you know, I asked about patients with those impulsive behaviors.
I warn everyone about it because one of my first patients started cheating on his wife, and I did not associate it with cabergoline. So now I warn everybody. Yeah.
The other thing I also wanted to add on cabergoline, because we use cabergoline most of the time for many things, right? Prolactinoma, acromegaly, Cushing. I even sometimes use that for clinical non-function adenoma.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when the dose of cabergoline going up, there is a dose effect on the cardiac valve. So especially when the dose is more than 2 milligrams a week, be a little careful about valvulopathy. So I usually do echocardiogram, just make sure, usually it's a tricuspid valve, but I just make sure that they are taken care of on that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I think with pegvisomant, it is not pituitary target therapy. All the others we talk about are pituitary target therapy. And then it does not reduce tumor size. Then you would wonder why there's increased tumor size. Mm-hmm. Right? The ACRO study, where there's a registry that's been more than 10 years, looking at those patients over 10 years, they did in some patients in a single digit, I believe somewhere between 4 to 8% of the patient may have some tumor increase. All the others are either stable or decrease in size.
Mm-hmm. There's a question actually about like what type of patient would you use pegvisomant in? And do we know what the mechanism of liver enzyme abnormality is, which I don't know, but I don't know
specifically, but remember this is a growth hormone receptor, and then the IGF-1 generation is 80% from the liver. Mm. By binding to the growth hormone receptor, I believe it's probably somewhere there have that effect. But among all this therapy, actually pegfilgrastim has the best in terms of sugar control, blood sugar control. If the patient is very poorly controlled diabetes, probably this is the one to go. Now, I think there are several aspects when you choose a therapy, right? You need to know, okay, most of the time there's a residual tumor or recurrent tumor. So what do you do with the tumor? And then what the comorbidity of this patient, you know, the cost, availability, right? And then all these things. And also pathology, too. I put a lot of emphasis with our neuropathology looking at, you know, what does it look like? Sparsely granulated or densely granulated, right? So do they express SGRT2? All this helped me to make a decision down the road what therapy I'm going to choose.
Yes. I would think probably most centers don't have access to neuropathologists who can do that, but if you do, yes.
Absolutely.
So we had a question about oral octreotide. So, yeah, let's talk about oral SRL therapies. I think this is an emerging, kind of have an emerging role in the care of these patients. And there's many reasons why patients may choose this or why it may be good for a patient, including, you know, patient wants oral therapy. They, you know, really don't like to get injections, or they have injection fatigue or burden. Again, you know, having to go to a doctor's office, having to take off work and all that time. It's really ideal for patients who are biochemically stable based on kind of what we know so far about the medications. I don't know if you, Jill, in your community, what your experiences with oral medications?
Well, a lot of patients, especially if they were having breakthrough symptoms towards the end of the injection cycle, would try to switch to a daily therapy. That was one of the main reasons that I see that patients would want to switch, but also travel.
Yeah.
You know, some of the injections can be difficult to travel with, and having an oral option is definitely...
Can you explain a little more of the breakthrough symptoms so the audience, someone may not be familiar with that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, when someone asks me what do breakthrough symptoms feel like, mm-hmm. I try to, what do you think it feels like whenever you're catching the flu and you hurt all over, kind of like an ache, mm-hmm. and you have fatigue, and add to that soft tissue swelling and headaches? Those are all breakthrough symptoms for a patient.
These are also happen right before the next injection.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So now we'll talk about what we have. So oral octreotide, there was a question about that. So there was a couple of phase 3 studies. This shows you results from the optimal trial. So in this study, patients with acromegaly had to be controlled on either lanreotide or octreotide. And then they were randomized to either oral octreotide or placebo. And oral octreotide uses a permeabilitizing agent to enhance its absorption in the intestines. It's twice a day, and it has to be taken on an empty stomach or 2 hours after eating. So this shows you the main results. If you compare at baseline in gray to end of treatment in purple, on the left is the mean IGF-1 and as a factor of the upper limit of normal, and the right is the mean growth hormone after five samplings. You can see that patients in the octreotide group maintain control as opposed to those in placebo, where the IGF-1 and the growth hormone went up. Next, the empowered study. So in this trial, again, it's patients well-controlled on first-generation somatostatin receptor ligands, and then they all went through a period where they were put on oral octreotide. And then they were randomized to either continue on oral octreotide or go go back to their prior somatostatin receptor ligand, octreotide or lanreotide. So this was really the primary endpoint was maintenance of biochemical control, which they defined as an IGF-1 less than 1.3 times the upper limit of normal. And this was to show non-inferiority, which you can see the primary endpoint on the left. You can see octreotide, the majority of patients maintain control. And then on the right, what's interesting, which maybe brings up some of what you brought up with symptoms, is if you look at patients, you know, at the baseline of the study, so when they were, you know, still on their injectable, as compared to after that run-in phase when they all went on oral octreotide, there was improvement in some of the symptoms, including, you know, swelling of extremities and fatigue.
So we have to remember that the long-acting injections work on a bell curve. Mm-hmm. So that's why the daily therapy probably does have some symptom control.
Yep.
Yeah, some of you may echo if you treat patients with testosterone shots, right before the next injection, if they do every 2 weeks shot, they usually have some symptoms of hypogonadism. Mm-hmm.
Next, we'll talk about paltusotine. Not everyone may not be familiar with this. So this is another oral agent. It is a potent orally bioavailable selective somatostatin receptor type 2 agonist. It's once a day. And so this shows you results from, there's two phase 3 studies, and the medication, the company is currently applied for NDA for this drug. So this shows you results from Pathfinder 1. In this study, similar to sort of the optimal trial, these were patients who were well controlled on either octreotide or lanreotide, and then they were randomized to either paltusotine or placebo. And on the left, you can see this is through the x-axis, you know, throughout the study, starting with baseline. So the left shows you the IGF-1, and in this study, about 84% of patients maintained control. If your IGF-1 was elevated and you had symptoms, you could go back on your injectable. So two people had to be rescued in the paltusotine group versus in the placebo. You can see on the right, about 4% of patients were controlled, and you can see the IGF-1 level going up. The Pathfinder 2 trial was different. In this study, they took, well, there was different arms, but there were patients who were medically naive and uncontrolled. So these could be patients who'd had surgery and were not controlled. Could also be people who were on somatostatin receptor ligand therapy prior. So, and these patients were randomized to either paltusotine or placebo. And the primary endpoint, which you're seeing at the top, is the proportion of patients who had an IGF-1 that was less than one times the upper limit of normal. So you can see in the paltusotine group, 56% versus placebo, only 5%. And then also listed are their secondary endpoints in which patients in the paltusotine group achieved these endpoints at a higher rate as well, including just the change from baseline in IGF-1, the proportion of patients who had levels IGF-1 less than 1.3 times the upper limit of normal. They also looked at the acromegaly symptoms, and a lower score is better, and also patients who achieved a growth hormone less than 1. So just as, you know, this is not a direct comparison, but kind of looking at those two oral agents, side effect-wise, they're similar, you know, nausea, diarrhea. Serious AEs were very rare in the trials with oral octreotide, none so far reported in the phase 2 and 3 trials for paltusotine. Discontinuation rate was low for both. Overall, well-tolerated. There's no hyperglycemia seen with either agent, really. Well, I guess there was some with oral octreotide, but not with paltusotine. Now moving on to CAM 2029. So this is not yet FDA approved. So this is a monthly sub-Q octreotide injection. So it uses a fluid crystal technology, And in situ, it develops into like a crystalline gel. And then as the matrix degrades, the encapsulated octreotide is released. So it's like a depot. And it's in a auto-injector pen that patients can use with a smaller gauge needle. I think it's 22 as compared to 18 with, you know, IM octreotide. And this shows you results from what's been published in the ACRO ANOVA 1 trial. So in this trial, another similar to the other trials, it's patients well controlled on either octreotide or lanreotide, and then they were randomized to either CAM2029 or placebo. And on the left, it's showing you the IGF-1 results, and on the right, the change in acromegaly index of severity scores. And you can see in red, you have the CAM2029, mean IGF-1 levels remaining under 1 times the upper limit of normal as compared to placebo. And then on the right, you see an overall improvement in the scores for acromegaly as well. So I think, you know, it's important to, there's multiple factors, right, that we've talked about that you take into account when deciding what sort of which way to go with therapy. Pegvisomant, you know, as we mentioned, could be considered for patients who have not achieved control with first or second generation somatostatin receptor ligands. You could consider adding cabergoline to patients not adequately controlled on first-line therapy. You can consider combination therapies, and there's multiple ways of doing it. You can do somatostatin receptor ligand and pegvisomant, often just a couple times a week. We talked about adding cabergoline. And then pasireotide is a good option for patients who are not controlled biochemically on octreotide or lanreotide. It does require close glucose monitoring, as there is a high percent of patients who will develop hyperglycemia, which is reversible if you stop the medication and very treatable. And then I think, you know, oral somatostatin receptor ligands, you know, can be considered for patients who are biochemically controlled, who may have injection fatigue or adherence issues, are, you know, right now they're not used to just overcome resistance of the somatostatin receptor ligands. I don't know if you want to add kind of any thoughts about.
Yeah. So this is, I think, you know, maybe seems like too complicated, I think, but once you know the mechanism, how this medication works, it actually makes sense because you think of all this medication, their target, right? So dopamine agonist, that's cabergoline, right? It's acting on the D2 receptor. And where the octreotide and lanreotide, and also the paltusotine acting on the SSTR2 receptor. Those are somatoreceptor in type 2, where pasireotide is acting on the type 5 receptor, I think. And then eventually you also have a medication targeting the growth hormone receptor. It makes sense that in some patients who are not controlled, you switch or adding on a different medication that targeting a different target. So it doesn't make sense if somebody is not controlled with octreotide, you switch to lanreotide, unless it's a compliance issue. Otherwise, it's probably not going to gain much of a benefit. But you could think about adding some other medication with switching. So those are the time you can do multiple things you can, as long as, you know, the patient is tolerating the medication, right?
And there's a question for Jill along these lines. Can you speak on resistance that patients may have to changing their therapy or how this should be addressed?
So it's very scary for a patient to change their therapy, even if it's not very effective for them. Because even if a patient gets some relief, it's still relief from this disease. And but I think that when you take the algorithms under advisement and you see that, for instance, years ago, I used to discuss how putting pegvisomant with an SRL, using the two different mechanisms, it kind of gave this disease the 1-2 punch. And it was able to get patients under control that weren't able to be in control previously. Mm-hmm. And one of the goals with this disease is for the patient to be in control of this disease instead of the disease being in control of the patient. Mm-hmm. And so often, the disease is in control of the patient.
And can you speak a little bit to, from the patient perspective, the importance of biochemical control versus symptom control?
Well, as patients, you know, we know those numbers are important, but it's symptom control that really impacts our daily life. And symptom control, in my opinion, and in a lot of the community's opinion, is most important to us, because it's the difference between us going back to lead a relatively normal life or us being in bed with fatigue and pain.
Right. Yeah, and the other two aspects, I think Dr. Silverstein and also Jill mentioned beautifully about the biochemical control and also symptom control. I want to add a little more is tumor control. Right? Don't forget there is still a tumor there. And so that's one thing. And then the other we mentioned earlier about the comorbidity control. Because the disease, we're not, we may be the center of it, but then we need help from other subspecialists to help us. And also one more thing about piclidenoson, different than all the other medication, you don't need to check growth hormone anymore once you start piclidenoson. Yeah. One of the key markers, just IGF-1, right?
Yeah.
Because growth hormone is not going to be very indicative of disease control.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, the growth hormone receptor was blocked.
Another thing that I'd like to add that we found, patients on piclidenoson, if they have an allergic reaction, if they go off the therapy for, you know, 3 weeks to a month, they can restart and that reaction doesn't come back.
Interesting. So I think we sort of talked about all the treatment. I'm going to skip this slide. So another case, 45-year-old woman with confirmed acromegaly presents for follow-up. She underwent transsphenoidal surgery 2 years ago for a macroadenoma, but had incomplete biochemical remission. She was initiated on long-acting lanreotide, 90 milligrams every 4 weeks. She reports persistent fatigue, joint pain, facial swelling. She complains about injection discomfort and increased injection site reactions. She admits occasionally delaying injections due to her work-related travel. She has well-controlled type 2 diabetes and arthritis, which is something we haven't talked about, but that's something that patients really struggle with even after their disease is treated. Her IGF-1 is 397, above the upper limit of normal, random growth hormone 3.6. On MRI, she has a stable residual adenoma, no optic involvement. Her A1C is 6.5%, and her LFTs are normal. So you have this 45-year-old woman with partial biochemical control on lanreotide who reports fatigue and breakthrough symptoms. So what is the most appropriate next step? Let's see what people said. Okay. There's a couple of different ways to approach this, I think, sort of getting at what I had asked Jill. So first is, like, what do we do in terms of biochemical control if we're going to focus on that? Looks like most people said add piclidenoson. So I actually, for this patient, I don't know. There's many ways to do this. You could increase her lanreotide potentially to 120 milligrams. You could maybe add cabergoline. This also, I guess, if you think about it from a different perspective, like what about if we're thinking more about not biochemical control, but just her symptoms and, you know, her fatigue, treatment fatigue. What do you guys think?
I mean, obviously she has some issues with the injections, right? And then also she have other symptoms, which clearly showing that the acromegaly is not controlled. I think the key part for us right now is to identify some barriers so we can get her the IGF-1 level under control. Because, you know, if you look at the data, the uncontrolled acromegaly does translate into increased comorbidities and mortality. So there is a reason we focus on number. Of course, that biochemical is not the only number we focus on, but there is a benefit of aiming for a control. So all these are potential options. Those are the times sometimes I go back to looking at the tumor if I can get a neuropathologist working with me to look at the tumor characteristics to try to have some prediction of what can happen. I mean, all these are viable options, right? I mean, even you switch to oral therapy, if she's concerned about all the injection site reactions and she doesn't like it. That in itself seems like affecting her compliance. Mm-hmm. Right? If there is something that increases her compliance, that's also something you can help.
Yes, I didn't mention that specifically, but the approval is for patients who are for maintenance therapy who are controlled on somatostatin receptor ligand. Yeah. Okay, now for sort of our next learning objective is how do we incorporate factors, including patient preferences, comorbidities, and potential barriers to adherence as part of individualized care while planning to optimize long-term management of acromegaly? And for this, I'm going to pass it on to Jill.
So I want to talk about quality of life and adherence challenges. Quality of life in acromegaly is often compromised due to fatigue, sleep apnea, and body image concerns. Common issues reported are joint pain, fatigue, headaches, sleep apnea, soft tissue swelling. Psychological, patients deal with a lot of depression, anxiety, body image issues. Cognitive, poor concentration, memory complaints. Short-term memory is quite a concern within patients. They deal with work impairment, stigma regarding the disease itself, relationship strains, within their sexual health, libido changes, reproductive issues, functional, because of all these issues, a loss of independence and difficulty with daily task. Because of delays in diagnosis and disease burden, patients typically, even post-surgery, they have long-standing symptoms, and they have a frustration or mistrust of the medical profession because of going so many years misdiagnosed. Their treatment is typically complex. We have to take multiple medications, including injections, somatostatin analogs, in order to control the disease and with lots of follow-ups. The side effects, there are GI side effects with the medications, gallstones, injection site reactions, hyperglycemia. Patients deal with, as I said previously, a lot of mental health issues, such as depression, body image concerns, cognitive changes. I was just in Europe with a mental health professional, and one of the things that she was discussing was how would you feel if your children didn't want you to drop them off at school because of the way that you looked? Oh my God. These are things that patients deal with. They deal with high cost of biologics, insurance limitations, and as physicians, I'm sure that you can understand that. And most patients have to travel for care. There's a poor understanding of this disease and the long-term complications of patients. You really need to take out the time to explain, to try to make their adherence better. So strategies for patient adherence. You need to build a strong therapeutic alliance with the patient. Bring the patient in and discuss treatment options. Make them part of the choice. Explain the chronic nature of the disease and the role of growth hormone and IGF-1. So many patients don't understand. You really need to explain all these things to them. Explain what high levels do to their symptoms and their long-term risk. Make sure that You point them towards support groups, give them written handouts, just try to improve their overall understanding of this disease. Simplify things when possible for the patient. Coordinate labs and imaging to reduce random visits. Screen regularly for the mental health issues that patients face, such as depression and anxiety. And if you do notice some changes, be sure and refer them to a mental health professional. Use technology such as medication reminders, telehealth visits. That was something that was transformational during COVID. Patients were getting access to some of the nation's top acromegaly physicians through telehealth. And use patient portals. Sometimes patients see those numbers even before you are able to discuss numbers with the patient because they're on those portals. Involve a multidisciplinary care team for those patients. Whenever they're diagnosed, be sure and let them know you're going to need to see, a cardiologist, an ophthalmologist. There's a whole nother care team that they have to see in order to manage this disease. Like I just said, a team-based approach. Yeah.
In managing acromegaly, right, it's not just about the pituitary. It's not just about the hormones. It's about the whole person. So, I mean, practically speaking, how can we bring all these specialists together? I have one patient who told me that he, whenever he sees a physician, he always asks if they know what acromegaly is. And if they don't, he educates them. What is your strategy?
So I think I tend to have a group of physicians. We work together very closely. For example, the radiologist, radiation oncologist, right? If you consider radiation therapy, neuropathologist, a whole group of doctors, neuro-ophthalmologists, well, and we are all interested in just the pituitary disease. So we got together and formed a multidisciplinary team, as Joe just mentioned. So you really need a team to work together with you to help the patient, because the patient is the center here.
And the other thing I think it's really important is, unless you ask, you're not necessarily going to find out about these things going on. I think patients may not volunteer it. They may think it's just normal for them, So I think it's important to, and we are all very busy and it can be very hard. You have a lot of patients. You're addressing their hypertension, their diabetes, sleep apnea. But if you take a moment to kind of ask them, do you have symptoms? They may say, yeah. No, but then you say, well, do you have so Jill's shaking her head.
So literally an extra 10 minutes with a patient can change their life. A patient, unless you name off the symptoms, will typically say, if they're not experiencing them at that very moment, they'll say that I'm fine.
Right.
Yeah.
But you need to go over the symptoms one by one and that will typically make them address it within their mind and say, you know what, maybe I am having more headaches. Yeah. Maybe I have noticed, these issues that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it can change life.
Right.
So I think we'll skip this. We've kind of already talked about all these things, I think. So we have another case, 52-year-old man with a history of acromegaly, previously treated with transfemoral surgery, who has been on long-acting octreotide, 30 milligrams IM every 4 weeks for 2 years. His biochemical markers have been within target range for 9 months. He complains of severe fatigue, low motivation, persistent sleep issues. He reports missing 2 of his last 6 injections due to transportation issues and schedule conflicts. He's recently been experiencing low mood, reduced libido, difficulty focusing. He states he is tired of the whole routine and feels discouraged. He lives in a rural area with limited access to endocrinology. He relies on his primary care practitioner and occasional telehealth consults. He denies joint pain or vision problems. So he has mild depression, controlled hypertension, borderline A1C, prediabetes. His lab shows IGF-1 is normal at 267, random growth hormone 0.9, MRI, stable post-op changes, no progression. On his symptom questionnaire, he reports moderate depressive symptoms. His TSH, I say really free T4 and testosterone are low normal. And his sleep study shows ongoing moderate sleep apnea. Which multidisciplinary approach would most appropriately address this patient's ongoing burden despite biochemical control? Yep. Most people, yep. I think we all agree, involve primary care, behavioral health, and sleep medicine. Good. So, you know, what does success look like? I think we've talked about it beyond biochemical control. You know, if it, just because a patient's biochemically controlled doesn't mean, you know, that they've been, everything clinically has been resolved. I think we've talked about why a multidisciplinary team is very essential, and to use the patient voice as a metric of success. I want to make sure we have time for questions. So I want to go through our SMART goals for this session. In patients with suggestive phenotypes for acromegaly, screen for IGF-1, evaluate new oral therapies for patients dissatisfied with injectable somatostatin receptor ligands, engage patients in shared decision-making to personalize treatment plans, and then coordinate care across specialties to manage comorbidities. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to collect your credit. And we have several questions. So I'll ask Dr. Huang, when should we check IGF-1 after transitioning to oral octreotide or adding cabergoline?
All right, so if adding cabergoline, and usually you can do that a month or two after adding cabergoline. And usually those are the cases where, like Dr. Silverstein mentioned, these are mildly elevated IGF-1, and usually less than 2 times the upper limit normal. Now, with the oral SRIs, you can check it as early as 2 weeks after you admit adding that or switch that. And so just because of the mechanism of action and also the half-life of the medication.
The other question kind of about medication is for those who patients you have who are well controlled over many years on injectable somatostatin receptor ligands, do you ever extend the dosing interval and how do you do that?
That's a very good question. So for lanreotide, you can go as often as frequent as every 8 weeks. Normally we do that every 4 weeks. You can do every 6, every 8. That definitely we have done that. So that's a really good option for those patients.
Yeah. And you can keep asking questions. We still have a little bit of time. There are some questions about paltusotine, about whether or not it can be used in combination. So remember, this is not FDA approved. It's still undergoing studies. So as of now, I mean, it's that we don't know exactly what its FDA approval is going to be. So I don't think we can say for sure. We just don't have the data to know if it can be added on to other therapies. Although I think, I don't know if you have thoughts about, not sure you would add, one somatostatin ligand on top of another, but.
I should never use.
I don't know. We never used two of them. Yeah.
There was one thing that, you know, probably years ago, if you attend the acromegaly talk, we always talk about something called SSA, right? So we call it somatostatin analog. These are exempted by octreotide and lanreotide because they look like the endogenous ligand, which is somatostatin. Now, the paltusotine obviously is different, and because it doesn't look like them, but acting on the same receptor, very similar receptor. So I think that the proper term now that Dr. Silverstein has used is RCL, somatostatin receptor ligand, because mm-hmm. we really care about what binds to the receptor mm-hmm. other than what they look like the endogenous ligand.
Yeah. Another question about cabergoline, which I do think you mentioned. Someone's asking about echocardiograms. So when the medicine is sometimes used to treat Parkinson's, right, I think those patients can be on 5 to 8 milligrams per day. When we use, and I don't know if it's specific, probably not in acromegaly patients, but in patients with prolactinomas, at the conventional doses we use, like 2 to 3 milligrams a week, there is no association between cabergoline and heart valve, physiologically significant heart valve problems. That said, when I start to escalate, and I think you said this, escalate the dose of cabergoline, I do get echocardiograms. Yeah. You may want to get an echocardiogram in your patient with acromegaly with hypertension, but that's a different thing.
You know, one thing also on the last case study, it showed the patient's IGF-1 level, but it also stated that they had missed several of their injections. It didn't say when they actually drew that IGF-1 level.
Right.
That IGF-1 level needs to be drawn the day prior to an injection. Do not do it post-injection because that won't be a true reading in the patient.
That's a very good point, yep.
Yeah, I think maybe you mentioned this, but it can take, you know, when we switch or increase doses of the SRLs, we wait till the third cycle to check an IGF-1. With the oral agents and with CAM-2029, you can check it sooner.
Yeah.
Another question we had was, I guess first, if you could just again mention how estrogen affects IGF-1 production, because the question is, if we start someone on estrogen, and please distinguish between oral and transdermal, do we have to change dosing of medications or surveillance?
I think that's a very good question. So just looking at the pathophysiologically, estrogen does induce a growth hormone resistance at the liver. In other words, it has to lower the IGF-1. If you think of those patients, I'm not sure we have taken care of those, but I happen to have a few who are pregnant patients who has acromegaly and end up getting pregnant. So we actually stop the medication. We monitor the patient, you know, because during pregnancy, the estrogen level was so high, and so the growth hormone resistance was high, so the patient actually have pretty much normal IGF-1. We just monitor them without need any treatment. That's not the case with, because I was talking, and going back to the birth control pills, we're talking about the oral estrogens, right? So the transdermal doesn't seem like have much of an effect as oral estrogen as that. I think adding estrogen, if somebody's not on it, you're adding it either as part of the birth control or as part of the hormone replacement therapy, depending on the status of the patient, you may see a little lower IGF-1 level as a result of that. As a matter of fact, there are some patients actually, I have a couple of patients I treat them with clomiphene, that actually have some good
results. Clomiphene, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
In male patients, like clomiphene also, because it helps raise the testosterone.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And lower IGF-1.
Yeah. But that's off-label use.
Yeah.
I should say that, yeah.
Another question about IGF-1. What are Z-scores, and do you use them?
What's your thoughts on
Well, it would be great if every lab, I think, used them because it represents within 2 standard deviations of the IGF-1. And I do more for, I guess, growth hormone deficiency. I think about the Z-score a little bit more. I think for acromegaly patients, I don't use the Z-score. I use more the IGF-1 level itself, I think, when I'm monitoring.
Right, so this is a very good question. I think, Dr. Silverstein said it really depends on the standard deviation of the IGF-1 assay. And each assay is different. You go to different places, they give you a different normal range. Mm-hmm. So the standard deviation is different. So we use that score and try to sort of normalize and looking at across different, assay platforms and how we compare one patient, same patient doing assay 1, 2, and 3, have some sort of comparison. But if we are aiming for a normalization of IGF-1, it has to be in that specific assay, has to be within the normal range. So then it doesn't really matter what the upper limit is.
Another question here is, if a thyroid ultrasound is negative at diagnosis, do you ever recheck? I will do a thyroid exam, every time I see the patient. I think if someone's if you've done an ultrasound and if there's a nodule, you would follow usual guidelines for that nodule. If you do an ultrasound and it's negative and they're controlled, I don't know that I would keep doing an ultrasound unless I felt something. I don't know if you think any different.
I do exactly the same.
Okay, good. There's another question about paltusotine, if it can be used in resistant patients. So I think we don't know. The trials have not compared it head-to-head to octreotide or lanreotide. A few other questions. Oh, this is a good one. So let's say you have a patient who has high IGF-1 multiple times, but the glucose suppression test is normal twice. What should you do? So I guess sort of depends on how high the IGF-1 is. I think if it's clearly high over 1.3, as I said, I don't put a lot into that growth hormone suppression test because it can be normal in patients with mild acromegaly. And there's a study that showed that. And the next step for me would be, especially if the patient has any signs or symptoms of acromegaly, the next step for me would be an MRI.
Yeah, I want to add to that. Sometimes we do see this discrepancy between the IGF-1
yes.
and growth hormone levels. And then it's really hard. And I think that put a lot of emphasis on the clinical suspicion whether the patient has the disease or not. You have to examine the patient, looking at all the comorbidities and things like that, and try to make a decision. And then, you know, also keep in mind, as Dr. Silverstein mentioned earlier, is about the growth hormone assay that you use, what are other factors that make the growth hormone lower, which is, mm-hmm. you know, and then the obese patient tend to have more lower growth hormone, whether or not, you know, what cutoff you use, what assay you use. This can become a very, I think, very complicated cases in some extent. And also, I use different platforms of IGF-1 assay. If assay I know from one
yes.
wonder is high, then I use the other
yes.
wonder. So maybe that gives you some
yes.
ideas, right?
Yes. And I think we have time for one other question, and I'll give this to Jill. What are the mechanisms causing fatigue in patients with acromegaly?
Oh, goodness. Mm. I think that when every cell in the body is overworking itself because of the growth hormone, an uncontrollable fatigue is there. I can remember times within my disease where I felt like if I didn't have a nap in the middle of the day, I was going to die. Mm-hmm. It is that pronounced, the fatigue is.
Mm-hmm. I think other things, you know, it's probably multifactorial in a lot of patients.
Sleep apnea. Many
right?
patients have sleep
yeah.
apnea.
Pain, you know, from osteoarthritis. I mean, chronic pain causes fatigue. And then, you know, patients who have hormone deficiencies, you know, could have fatigue related to their hypothyroidism or low testosterone. So there's probably multiple factors.
Or even the depression.
Depression, for sure.
Yes.
Yes, depression, for sure. Yeah. So if you know anybody who missed this CME, it will be available online as listed there. And again, I think I, on behalf of my colleagues, thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.